and a little feel of the 60s, of course, Jackie DeShannon and the classic song. And we're talking with Jeff Kelly. He's the author of DMZ Diary and also has just recently returned from Afghanistan. We'll get to your calls in a few moments. But Jeff, you wanted to tell me a story about one of the ministers over there that had a little violent interference with things?
Right. This happened during the Festival of Eid, which is a big, sort of like Christmas is to the Islamic world. And everybody was taking a long four-day weekend, and everybody wanted to get back to Islamabad, because most of the ministers, and that's where everything happens. That's you can get things in Islamabad, whereas Kabul is very, very basic. So they all wanted to go back there. And so I had all these flights cancel on me because of weather. And then we managed to get one airplane in, and I had about 300 people trying to get on a 75-seat airplane. So I had to decide who went. And one of the ones who I chose was, I chose all the UN staff, number one, and then diplomats. And then that left a handful of diplomats could go, and this minister was one of the ones I chose. And we started boarding the airplane. It finally got in. We weren't sure it was going to get in. Finally, it broke through the clouds, found a hole, came in. We started boarding the people, but he didn't like the fact that he was not receiving a VIP treatment to go. And we had other actual ambassadors from Western countries who were also waiting in line. But this guy took it into his head that he should be pre-boarded. And he went up to my staff member and started berating him. And then he started punching him. I couldn't believe it. Or no. I just turned around and I saw this guy beating up my staff member. And I ran up there and broke it up. And they're yelling and screaming in Dari. And of course, I didn't know what was going on until later. But I think this guy was the Minister of Justice. And I think it shows the attitude of he was a Uzbek. And you have the Northern Alliance, which are Tajiks and Uzbeks mostly, ethnic Tajiks and Uzbeks, which is the northern countries bordering Afghanistan. Formerly, they were part of the Soviet Union. And these guys are really rough. And once the Laura Jirga has their election, which is going to be this week, actually, they're probably going to be voted out. And when they do get voted out, it's going to be interesting to see what they do, because they could turn violent.
Mm-hmm. At least we have a known quantity now.
Well, the problem is each minister has his own little army. And the National Army is only 600 men that they've trained. And these armies could start fighting amongst each other.
Let's take a call. Area code 305-995-1800. We have a couple of lines open. James in Pinecrest, hi.
Hi, how's it going? Just wanted to ask Jeff a question. I used to be one of the contractors that operated the aircraft in Africa for the United Nations, both the World Food Program and the UNDP, and worked in Somalia, Sudan, Rwanda. And one of the reasons we stopped doing contracts with the UN was the incredible corruption at the upper level in WFP working through agents. And the other thing was the people in UNDP hitting them up for bribes. And it had gotten so bad that 10 people in the central office in New York got suspended and investigated.
You guys are kind of giving us alphabet soup.
Yeah, UNDP is United Nations Development Programs, World Food Program. And we were working with World Food Program Lifeline Sudan. And also with UNICEF, we were dropping food with buffaloes, running caravans, and running the back-and-forth service with the Beach 1900s. And it had gotten so bad that the entire UNICEF staff at Lifeline Sudan was arrested by the Kenyans for corruption. It had become so blatant. And I'm just curious if it had been proved, because we stopped working for the UN and went to work for the European Community, developed the EcoFlight system, which was a much more equitable system for moving NGOs and the diplomats and donor units around. And I just wondered if it degraded to what it had been in Africa and Afghanistan.
Well, I wasn't with the aviation in Africa. I was in communications over there. But I do know about Lifeline Sudan, and this is the first time I've heard about the corruption.
Oh, it's incredible.
I've heard UN accused a lot of inefficiency, but I've never seen corruption in the UN, although I don't doubt it could exist. And but as far as our operation over in Afghanistan, we have mostly South African crews, and there was, at least to this point, there's no bribery, or I never saw any of that.
Well, it's interesting you talk about that. It was inefficient. It was so inefficient from the donor country standpoint, particularly the European community, that EchoFlight was born out of that, which was basically an airline that does nothing but relief flying and equitably shared out on a priority basis and first come, first serve. I mean, we had UN diplomats that would take the Citation jet, fly to Mogadishu for a conference, and fly back, but they never met with anybody. They met with themselves, and all it was to get $360 of per diem for the day, and they'd waste $10,000 on a jet flight. I mean, the inefficiency of the way the UN utilized the aircraft, which, you know, by and large, the UN actually doesn't do anything. They're an administrating agency, and the NGOs actually do the work. And the NGOs were constantly being bumped off the aircraft in favor of some UN guy who had to get back to push through a travel claim.
We had a partial funding by ECHO, which is the European Community Organization.
The Humanitarian Office, correct.
Right. Part of the deal was we had to give 50% of the seats to NGOs.
So they did push their weight into that.
Right. But they had to book the seats 48 hours in advance.
Well, that was typical, yeah.
Yeah. And the problem was they forgot about that 48-hour booking thing. And they thought that being NGOs, that they could bump off some agency head. And I couldn't allow that. You know, the contract stated 48 hours in advance, and they didn't comply with that. So we did have some problems. But I did my best to bend over backwards for ECHO because they were big donors for our organization.
They don't fly without money. You have to please the donor agencies. That's why they were number two on our priority. We always had to move donor agencies as second priority after NGOs.
Okay, James, we have to run.
Thanks. Take care now.
Thank you for your call, 305-995-1800. We're probably going to be shifting to some of the Vietnam experiences in a few minutes. Ignacio, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was a civilian contractor in Vietnam in 1968. And while there, I began to think about our presence in Vietnam, and I pretty much concluded that we really had no business being there. I had to deal a lot with the Vietnamese because most of my time was spent in Da Nang, which was a Vietnamese base, though for all practical purposes under American control. But nonetheless, you had to do everything double with the U.S. Armed Forces and with the Vietnamese. So we were involved in a kind of nation building that I thought was not going to get us anywhere, as unfortunately, eventually, our experience brought my initial thoughts to be correct. Now, what does this gentleman's, Mr. Kelly's, Mr. Kelly, what is your experience from Vietnam? How do you feel about your Afghan experience from your experience in Vietnam? Though I realize that, whereas I was a civilian in Vietnam, you were actually in combat.
Well, the two experiences are not even close. I was a combat troop, as you said, in Vietnam. I was far from any civilians. We were all in a free fire zone the entire time I was there.
Yeah.
And in Kabul, I was doing, different type of work. However, one day at the airport in Kabul, a firefight broke out amongst the French peacekeepers, the ISAF, which is International Security Assistance Force for Afghanistan, and some unknown persons off in the weeds there in the airport. And seeing those tracers fly out over the tarmac kind of brought me back to Vietnam for a few seconds, but luckily it was not aimed at me, so I was, and all I had to do was find some cover, which is, a lot easier than having to go after those guys. Other than that, they really have nothing to do with each other.
Right. So in other words, in Vietnam, you didn't really have to deal with Vietnamese society as such, just battlefield.
No. The area, I was on the DMZ, the border between North and South Vietnam.
Yeah, I was a little further south than that. I was in Da Nang.
I've been to Da Nang.
I live by Freedom Hill.
Right. Da Nang, to us, was the land of hamburgers and beer. It's a great place.
Absolutely. The Navy section in China Beach looked almost like a country club. How did you enroll in the Afghanistan program? How did you go about doing that?
Well, I sent my resume, and since I had worked for Delta Airlines and had a lot of airline experience, I emailed them my resume, and they called me the next day. Plus, I had prior UN experience.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks,
well,
Ignacio.
Thanks a lot. By the way, Da Nang wasn't entirely a country club. We got hit several times. I just wanted to fix that. Okay. Good care.
Okay. All righty. Thanks for calling. 305-995-1800. I believe it was Da Nang that you flew into when you were green, before you had any combat.
Right.
And you spend quite a bit of time in DMZ Diary before you were itching to get into combat. And, of course, there was the fear I guess everyone would have is, do I really have the courage to do this? And a little difficulty eating before going out there. Tell us.
Yeah, I think it's a product of too many John Wayne movies and that whole post-World War II mentality of esteem that was heaped on veterans. And I was looking for that for myself. And I don't think I had a whole lot to do with patriotism or I didn't even know what or where Vietnam was. But this was a place to test myself. And that's really why I went. I volunteered to go. And arriving in Da Nang, we flew into Da Nang, and within hours, I was on a C-130 up for the DMZ. And I was what was known as a BNG, or a brand new guy, also known as a cherry. And it was kind of fun in the beginning, the excitement, a little scary, but I was kind of grooving on it in the beginning. And then as I state in my book, all of a sudden you have an epiphany where you see, oh my God, this is for real. This is not a movie. And then, but by that time you're stuck, you're there and you have to finish the thing.
Tell us about your first patrol. You almost tried to be a hero.
Which one, what are you referring to?
When you went out on patrol and, some action, and you tried to take your pistol and go after these guys, and somebody tackled you and said, hey, this isn't John Wayne movie, this is for real.
Right. We were just moving out to Hill 28, which is, I was on a place called Alpha 3, which is 200 meters from the DMZ, and Hill 28 is in front of that. So Hill 28, the front part of it, was actually inside the DMZ, and we were being shifted out there as sort of a tripwire. If they hit it, anything, they would hit us first. And we were digging in, and I hadn't seen nobody had shot at me yet. And all of a sudden, they started hitting us with mortars. And I grabbed a pistol, and I was going to run up to the line there and pop off a few rounds. Of course, I had no chance of doing any damage to a mortar. And the guy who was training me tackled me and gave me a stern talking to and tried to get this notion out of my head. He didn't, but the experience did, and it took about a few months.
I think he said something about, you operate our radio. Our guys depend on you when they need help, either with artillery or to get them out to evacuate them. If you're dead, they're in big trouble.
Right. That's what he said, yeah. He said, you're a communicator, not a grunt, and you don't do them any good if you're dead.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what you did exactly.
I was part of the Tactical Air Control Party, and we called in helicopters. We communicated with for resupply or for medevacs, mostly medevacs. We spoke with AO, aerial observer spotter planes, who were your basic Cessna that would fly above the battlefield and give us an aerial view and tell us what they could see. And also we called in fixed-wing airstrike, which are jets. And the Marine Corps relies heavily on jets since we have our own internal air force. And so that's part of our Marine Corps doctrine is the use of close air support. And we're very good at it. And so those three things were my main preoccupations.
305-995-1800 if you'd like to join in. 305-995-1800. Until you read this memoir, it's kind of difficult to describe some of the situations and things that you saw, but I was very struck with you'd be on patrol so long, and you wouldn't bathe, of course. The clothes were actually rotting off you, and what you had to do to survive in that jungle setting and to avoid being surprised by the enemy at night.
Yeah, we were all about teamwork, and we worked as a team, and we would set in a 360-degree perimeter. Each of the holes would have interlocking fields of fire. We would have to, you'd have to rotate, sleep, one guy awake, one guy asleep. If when it's your turn to sleep, if the other guy falls asleep, and this happened to us in May, and the NVA pick your hole to try and break and to overrun you. Actually, in that case, in May, they were breaking out because we had a cordon operation, and they threw a Chi-Com grenade into this hole and killed both guys, and then they came running through, and I remember that. In fact, I was just about this time. When these things happen, you remember the dates, and we would always say, "Do you remember 8th, or May the 8th, or March 6th?" Or the days when big things, big battles happened, and we were in a huge battle, and it later became known as the Battle for Dong Ha. At the time, we were calling it the Second Battle of Daido, and because there was a battle in the beginning of May and another one at the end of May, and we were involved in the one at the end of May, and I'll never forget, it killed these guys, the two guys, Willoughby and Myers, threw the grenade into the hole, killed them. The NVA came running through, and carrying wounded, and probably were a CP group. And I woke up, and I saw these people moving, and I didn't know what it was, and I heard some shooting, and the next thing you know, they were gone. So to get back to your original question is, that's what we did, what we had to do to stay alive. I don't know, it's kind of a vague question. Hard to answer specifically.
Mm-hmm. 305-995-1800. Jeff Kelly is my guest. He's the author of DMZ Diary. And there's a website that I was on. Do you have the address handy? Or?
Yeah.
I just put DMZ Diary into Google and got there.
Right. DMZDiary.com. www.dmzdiary.com.
And what was rewarding for me after I read the book and got to know some of your comrades, some of them who died in the war, I was able to see their pictures and got to see what they looked like. It was very, very rewarding. And if you can also order the book on the website, I believe, too.
Right. There's a button, click buy the book, and that'll take you to booklocker.com, who is the publisher.
Now, were you kind of glad in retrospect that you were in the DMZ where it was a fire zone and anybody who wasn't an American soldier or a South Vietnamese soldier had no business being there, and you didn't have to make these choices of villagers, were they this or were they that? Or
right, it definitely simplified things. If it moved and it didn't have a South Vietnamese or a Marine uniform on, you could shoot it. For one time, we did go down to the Qua Viet area, and there were civilians there, and it became very complicated. And also the fact that on the DMZ, because their troops were moving through, they really couldn't mine the area, because if they did, they would have got as many of their own troops as they would have us. So mines weren't a big problem on the DMZ. The downside of that was they had artillery. On the other side of the Ben Hai River, it was just bristling with artillery, 152 millimeter, 130, 105s, 122s. And we received World War II style shelling of artillery that most other veterans who served further south, away from the Ben Hai River, didn't have to experience. Of course, they had mortars and rockets and other nasty things as well.
What is that like, that real World War II style bombardment to experience?
It's terrifying. If it's 152 millimeter, it has a high trajectory, and if you're real aware, you hear a very faint pop, and then you have maybe 3 seconds to find a hole or find a low spot to be in when it hits. If it's a 130 millimeter, which has a flat trajectory, almost like a naval gunfire, you don't hear anything except the round. You hear it a millisecond, you hear the round, before it hits, a millisecond, it comes in, you hear a screech and it explodes. That's really terrifying.
Let's take a caller here. We're going to probably be jumping around between Afghanistan and Vietnam, but we'll muddle through. Juan in Miami. Hi. Go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon. I wanted to ask the question is, could it be possible that we're walking into another Vietnam? I read in the paper today where the British are now guarding the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the same thing. We don't know what they, you know, there's no uniforms, and they're both the same religious zealot. Are we going to have to stay there forever to stabilize the country? And I'll take the answer off the air. All right? Thank
you. Okay.
Well, it's a lot smaller than Vietnam. The British have, I think, 1,700 Royal Marines there, and they have some ISAF forces as well. The Americans have, I think, 7,000 forces there, and that's nothing compared to Vietnam. We had almost 1 million troops there at one time. Mm-hmm. And they're hunting the people there, these Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces. They're hunting a number in the hundreds. This is an opinion I'll give you, I'm no expert on this, so let me just qualify that. But the rumors are that I heard was that the reason we're there is to stabilize the country, basically from internal division, in other words, from the different commanders fighting each other, and they want a stable Afghanistan, so that they can build a pipeline from the natural resources in Uzbekistan and in Tajikistan down through Afghanistan, through Pakistan, and then have these natural resources available for the West. And of course, the Russians don't like this idea. The Russians want that stuff to stay there, come up through Russia, and go over to Europe. And supposedly this is the scuttlebutt you hear. So I don't know how true it is.
And so that would be taking oil out of the hands of the Arab world.
Well, in other words, an alternative source.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. 305-995-1800. Constanza in Plantation. Hi.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Okay, good. Let me ask a question. After being there, and you said that we really do not comprehend the mentality of these people because of their beliefs, their religion, and after being there, what would you say what do they want? Do they want to be left alone? Do they want to be modernized? What do you think that their aspirations are after all this that has happened to them? Do they just want to live in peace and be left alone? How do you see it? And I'll take my answer off here. Thank you very much.
Okay.
No, they want peace and they want money because they have nothing there. They have been completely spent. And that's what they're after. They're after international community to come in there and help to give them some money and to restore peace. The big danger is that they're going to start squabbling amongst themselves. And I can give you a quick example of that. In Mazar, the U.S. Army was running the show. And then they decided they no longer needed to be in Mazar, so they left. They were running the airport. And they had some local air traffic controllers up in the tower. And they had been transporting them to and from home. So when the U.S. Army left, they left a vehicle. And they said, this is for the air traffic controllers so that they can work the tower. What happened was, the minute the Army left, the next day, the Ministry of Interior Police seized the vehicle and said, we want this vehicle because we think we deserve it more than you. And the air traffic controllers said, we're threatened, we're abandoning the tower, plus we have no transportation. And it took a representative from Chairman Karzai's office to fly in there and negotiate this settlement. It's where they would share the vehicle. And that's an example that there's no wealth at all in the country, and anything, even one vehicle, can get them squabbling. So if the Western forces were to leave, you would see civil war with 30, 40 different players.
Right. Our number, 305-995-1800. We're going to take another short break on Topical Currents. My guest is Jeff Kelly. He's returned from the United Nations Humanitarian Air Service in Kabul. And he's also the author of DMZ Diary. We'll be back with more.